It's good to see you all. The weather continues to get better. I'm happy to go outside now, and I'm delighted to be here this morning. See some visitors with us, some familiar faces as well. Glad you all are here today. The brethren have asked me to give some lessons on evangelism. And so a couple of weeks ago, we looked at the account of Jesus at the well in Samaria with the Samaritan woman from the city of Sychar in John 6. This morning, I want to kind of take that thought and that story and expand it a little bit. Let me begin by asking you a simple question. What is the sign of a thriving assembly of God? We are here, His children, in His kingdom, assembled today. Are we thriving? Are we not? How would we know one way or the other? One thing that churches need to be is hospitable and social with each other. That's not why we're here right now. It's got nothing to do with our gathering this morning. But we need to prefer each other, and that's in every sense and in every way. So should we say that maybe lots of potlucks are a sign of a thriving church? Pam and I missed a gathering last night, which we very much wanted to be at. She's sick, and I got asked to go preach over at Northeast in Clearwater because the gentleman who was to lead the meeting, Gary Henry from Nashville, was taken very, very ill. If you know Brother Henry, you might pray for him. Taken very ill. We couldn't be there. And I regret that because I would rather gather, even if it's social in nature, with my brethren than to miss out on things like that. But maybe a big contribution is a sign of a thriving church. We've had to think about our budget lately, and we thought about it carefully, and brethren are working here in spite of the economy, in spite of the challenge of finding work and keeping it. But is that really the sign of a thriving congregation? Or maybe peace among brethren. That's good. We need it. We have it here, as far as I know. The brethren here in the work, the families of various members are at peace with each other. And that's a beautiful and wonderful thing. And more than that, God requires it of His children. But let me suggest to you that evangelism, more than anything, and perhaps not the only thing, but more than anything, evangelism is a sign of a thriving congregation. As I mentioned in our first lesson, as we look at this again today, there's some images I would like for you not to have in your mind, please, when we think about evangelism. Images like me up here in front of a pulpit. What I'm doing right now is not wrong, or we wouldn't do it. But that's not what I want you to think about. I don't want you to think about crowds or huge auditoriums or very magnificently prepared presentations. What I'd like for you to think about are two or three people, you, someone else, friends, relatives, co-workers, neighbors, strangers. And let's keep that in our mind, just like we did a couple of weeks ago. And let's think about evangelism. The first thing I want us to look at is when Christians think about evangelism, they often think in this context. I hope we don't, but just in case, bear with me. We think about it as being the preacher or the elder's jobs. Well, indeed, the elders have a responsibility in a congregation where there's elders to oversee the spiritual welfare of the church. And that means both inside and outside. Preachers today are called evangelists, although a lot of us, sadly, don't spend a significant amount of our time evangelizing the way we see in Acts. And that's a different subject and a serious one. But is evangelism primarily or just the jobs of those men? Sometimes folks think, well, I can't really teach anyone. I don't have the knowledge. But they'll say, well, that's okay because of the first line. Now, we need to have the knowledge. We're not to be, and the scriptures teach us we mustn't be, babes in Christ our whole time here on the earth. But that also doesn't mean that everybody has the same amount of knowledge. And so if we're lacking, we need to work on that. It's really not that hard at all to get the knowledge that you need in order to share the joy of your certainty and your salvation with others. But then other people look for a cookbook process, a system, a method, a certain book, a certain video. I'm not mocking those things. There are some excellent DVDs out for those who are coming to Christ and for those who just have. But it's not about a cookbook process. It's about you and me doing the things that should come naturally to us as joyous children of God. Because a cookbook process or anything else is not going to guarantee results. And at the end of this lesson in a few minutes, we'll look at what it is that produces the results. It's not you, and it's not me. And you might think, well, that's an odd thing to say. Aren't you talking about evangelism? Yes. And isn't evangelism supposed to produce results? Absolutely. But you'll see my point shortly. In the meantime, though, I want you to consider something. Turn over to Ephesians 5, beginning at verse 14. The reason that clock was on the first slide is because all of us here have so much time. And we need to use our time wisely. And Paul tells the church in Ephesus, and he tells the church in Colossae very similar things. To the Ephesians, he says, "Awake, you who sleep, arise from the dead." Well, I chided my class this morning. They seemed to be a little bit dead. And they told me, most of them, that was because they didn't get enough sleep last night. I didn't know if it was that or my lousy teaching. But here Paul is talking to an entire congregation. He's not trying to be mean. There's nothing in the context that says Paul came in there with a hatchet and just started swinging it in all directions, hoping he'd hit somebody. He says, awake. He's trying to encourage them. You who sleep, arise from the dead, and Christ will give you light. Well, what in the world is that supposed to mean? Well, keep reading. See then that you walk circumspectly. It means very carefully, thoughtfully, meaningfully. Not as fools, but as wise. Redeeming the time because the days are evil. Redeem means to buy something back. Have you ever heard the phrase, I need to buy some time? You know, we've got a project going on at work and it's behind schedule. I don't have enough people to put on it. I need to find me some time somewhere. We use those kinds of phrases all the time. The fact is, you can't buy any time. But we still understand what we mean when we say that. We've all got the same amount of time. Everybody knows that. And so we manage it as best we can. And Paul is telling Christians, you better be, spiritually speaking, good time managers. Because the days are evil. Therefore, do not be unwise, but understand what the will of the Lord is. But we don't have time today to take up Jesus' parable, or metaphor, maybe it might be better, of the vine and the branches. We're here to bear fruit. We may see that in a sermon soon, but not today. We're here to bear fruit. And that's part, and very high on the list, of what the will of the Lord is for us. And so over in Colossians chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, the passage that Joe read, I've got to find out what translation you got, brother. That's the best rendering of that passage I've heard. And I don't have it. I hope you remember the way it was read, but I'm going to read it the way my New King James says. I'm going to find out what Joe's translation is. Paul says, walk in wisdom. Remember? He told the Ephesians to be wise in what they did. Walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. We have a responsibility not just to be an example before those who are around us. Folks, people are looking at you. Your family, your neighbors, your co-workers. I'm not trying to make you paranoid. They're not, you know, sitting there taking notes. Maybe. Probably not. But they're looking at you. They're watching you because they know something about you. Do they know that you're a Christian and that your faith rules your life? Have they gotten to know you? Or do they just see that there's something different? When something goes wrong, you don't fly off the handle. You don't start cursing. You don't threaten people. You don't lie. You don't tell foul stories, whatever it may be. And they're looking and they're watching. And so we have an example. But more than that, what's the example for? Do we say, well, I was a good example today and therefore I'm done? What's the purpose of being a good example? If it's not to ultimately lead to fruit for God, to win souls, there's no point. There's really no point. And so he says, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. Each one who? Those who are outside. We interact with them. We come before them. We are an example to them, and we need to reach out to them. Now, is Paul saying that you better have the entire Bible memorized? No, he just the New Testament. Wait a minute. How many people who went out in Acts 8 after the persecution had all of the Old Testament memorized? Some of them probably did, but how many? Can we really count on that as a prerequisite? What did they do when they went out preaching the gospel, the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, the life he lived, the examples that he gave, the miracles he performed, and the commands that he taught? How much of that do I need to know to explain to someone that it would be wonderful if they came to church and worshiped and met the people at my church and listened to what we had to say and opened the Bible with us and saw in the Bible itself what it says? How much knowledge, word by word, verbatim memorization do I need? Should I be ignorant of the scriptures and the Bible and have no idea? Nope, that's not a good idea. Bad plan. But am I waiting to talk to anyone because I don't have the New Testament memorized? Well, I'm in trouble, and so are they, because they're not going to hear. So I'm holding back. I'm afraid. I'm fearful. I'm timid. Let's not do that. Let's do what Paul said. Let's be smart about what we do toward those who are outside the faith, because we only have so much time. And there'll be a day come when that time is over. And when that time is over, all we could have ever done will have been done. And if it wasn't much or nothing, God will ask us about that in that day when he finds us unworthy. Let that not be what happens. Instead, let us know how to answer each one who talks to us. Not by quoting all the Gospel of Matthew, but by being able to explain to them and to invite them, to intrigue them, to captivate their mind to come in and be with us. And let's look at some examples. Let's start in the Old Testament. Now, you might think the Old Testament is a strange place to talk about evangelism because people didn't evangelize back then. Well, not as far as spreading the gospel of Jesus Christ. They sure didn't. But I want you to think about Rahab, and I want you to think about Ruth. Rahab, the prostitute. The prostitute of Jericho, the only one I don't know, but in Joshua 2, it makes it very clear that that's who she was. And the spies who were sent out by Joshua end up in her house. There's a lot of jokes made about how that happened. Really? They're there to spy out the town. That might not be the place where most people would come looking for them. I don't know why they ended up there, but they did. You know what's interesting about the story is not all of that speculation or any of that kind of nonsense that people who write about the Old Testament, and particularly the book of Judges, like to wonder about. What's interesting is that she knew that Jehovah God, or Yahweh, as some people say, had brought Israel out of slavery, out of bondage in Egypt, and had brought them through a land that was an absolute barren mess. Nobody went out there to live. Nobody in the nations around that place walked through there, and God took them right through there to the front door of Jericho, and she said to those spies, you know what? Your God has done this. And so I'm asking you, when you come, spare my family and me. And they said, if you'll do the following things, and they gave her a few simple things to do, we'll be sure that we get you all out before we ruin this city. She asked. She inquired. She had belief. The knowledge of the law of Moses that those spies had, the knowledge that the priests had, not at all. But she believed and she asked. What if the spies had said, are you kidding me? Bring a whore into the camp of Israel? That's not going to happen. That's not what they did. You know, she wasn't the mayor's wife. It was a good thing because he died. Whoever the king or the leader of Jericho was, they all got wiped out, but she didn't. You know what else? Rahab, the prostitute of Jericho, is in the bloodline of Christ. What does it take to save someone? Their faith, a faith that's strong enough to make them act. Well, what about Ruth, the Moabite pagan woman? Naomi's family went down there to get away from the terrible thing that had come upon Israel. No crops, a drought, a famine, nothing. And down there they marry two women, of whom one of whom is Ruth. And when the time comes for Naomi, her sons and husband dead, to go back home to Israel because the famine is over, she tells her daughters-in-law, I release you, I've got nothing for you. Ruth said, no, I'm coming with you. She says, your God will be my God. Did she know what she was saying? Well, she meant that. But there's no evidence that she had any more knowledge of the covenants than Rahab did. The spies redeemed Rahab. Boaz redeemed Ruth. And lo and behold, a Moabite pagan woman who's no longer pagan, but still of Moabite origin, is in the bloodline of Jesus Christ. You see Boaz walking up and going to Naomi, what in the world did you bring this pagan woman into our town for? Why is she here in Bethlehem? What were you thinking? No, he didn't do that. He redeemed her. He didn't care. In fact, he told her, it's been well reported to me, fully reported to me, the kind of woman that you are. And he didn't mean by that a pagan. He meant her virtue, her good behavior, her kindness to her mother-in-law. You're going to turn away from stuff like that? No, folks. When we see people who are interested, who are motivated, who are willing, we've got to respond and we've got to answer and we've got to reach back when they reach out to us. And be attentive, have your ears open, because sometimes people are timid to reach. Their reach may be almost inaudible, but it may still be there. Those spies didn't laugh or spit in Rahab's face, although some of her customers probably had. And Ruth was accepted in Bethlehem, in spite of the fact that she was not of the stock of Israel. Well, let's open up the New Testament. Let's look at the story of the adulterous woman, the woman who was caught literally in the act of adultery. John 8, beginning in verse 3, it says, the scribes and Pharisees brought to him, talking about Jesus, a woman caught in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said to him, teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned, but what do you say? Now they said that so they could set him up to see if he'd stumble over himself or they'd have a reason to criticize him. But he stoops down, he pretends like he doesn't hear them, and he's just drawing in the dust of the ground with his finger. And so they kept asking him. So finally he stands up and he says, okay, he who is without sin among you, you be the first one to pick up a rock and hit her with it. That's all he said. And amazingly, verse 9, it says, those who heard it being convicted by their conscience. It's good to hear that they had one. As self-righteous as some of these people were. They went out one by one, beginning with the oldest, even to the least, and Jesus was left alone, and the woman standing in the midst. And Jesus raised himself up and saw no one but the woman. He said to her, "Woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you?" And she said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said to her, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." Now, did she sin? Yes. Did he acknowledge that? Yes. Oh, well, he judged her. No, he acknowledged that she'd sinned. That's not judgment. But he wasn't there to condemn. He was there to save. And he told her, "I'm not going to condemn you either. I'm not going to stone you. I'm not going to reject you. An adulterous woman, a pagan woman, a prostitute, all worthy of being reached out to, even if they don't seem to be like you or me." What about Philip and Nathanael? Turn over to John 1. You know, Jesus, when he began his ministry, one of the first things he did was to begin to draw people to him. He went to where John was baptizing and teaching. And ultimately, some of the people he drew to him became his disciples, the 12 who were with him almost all the time for the remaining time of his ministry. And so Philip met Jesus. And Philip went and found Nathanael after Jesus had said to Philip, "Follow me." And he went and found Nathanael. In John 1, beginning in verse 43, it says, "The following day, Jesus wanted to go to Galilee, and he found Philip and said to him, 'Follow me.' Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. And Philip found Nathanael and said to him, 'We have found him, of whom Moses and the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph.'" Wow. Philip is reaching out. He's telling somebody, "You need to come and meet this man. This man is the Messiah. We found him." And what's Nathanael's reaction to Philip's enthusiasm? He says, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Maybe he stayed there once upon a time, wasn't impressed. I don't know. Galilee, Nazareth, no big town. You know what Philip says to him? "Ah, you're right. Never mind." No. Philip didn't say, "Well, you're stupid anyway. I just thought I'd tell you, but I don't care if you don't like it. I'm going to go follow him. You can do whatever you want." No. Philip didn't give him any kind of mean or defensive reaction. He said, "Come and see. You know, you come with me and you see and you judge for yourself. Make up your own mind." And so Nathanael took the offer. Verse 47, Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and said of him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no deceit." Wow, what a compliment. Jesus looked at Nathanael and knew his heart. And Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" And Jesus answered and said to him, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Well, the skeptic is convinced and he believes. Nathanael answered and said to him, "Rabbi, you're the Son of God. You're the King of Israel." And Jesus answered and said to him, "Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You'll see greater things than these." And so he did. And so did they all. And all because one man went to another man and said, "You need to come and experience what I have. You need to come and see this man I've met. You need to come and meet him yourself." And in reaction to a little bit of skepticism, he just said, "Well, come and see for yourself then. You come on." That's all he said to him. And he came. And when he saw, he was convinced. And what a difference that made in the life of Nathanael. Well, what about the publican Zacchaeus? Luke 19, if you want to turn there. We know the story of Zacchaeus. Jesus is going through Jericho. And verse 2 says, "Now behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus who was a chief tax collector." He wasn't your average tax collector. He was a boss man tax collector. And he was rich. Well, indeed, in those days, that's what happened. You cheated the people. And he sought to see who Jesus was. He was curious. He wanted to know, but because of the crowd, he couldn't. For he was of short stature. He was a little man. He was not tall, and he couldn't see over everybody else's heads and shoulders. But he wanted to see who this Jesus was that everyone had heard about. And so he climbs up in a sycamore tree. Verse 5 says, when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and saw him and said to him, Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must stay at your house. Now, I wouldn't recommend that specific strategy. If you find someone who's curious about who you are, or why you live the way you do, or why you don't do things that other people in the world do, it might not be the best thing to say, well, I'm going to stay with you tonight and explain that. But you can do almost exactly that and say, well, why don't you come over to my house? Or let's go sit down over here if you've got a few minutes. Or why don't you meet me tomorrow for lunch? And let me tell you exactly why I am the way I am. And more than all of that, will you come to church with me and meet my family? I'd like for you to meet my family. We can do that. It says in verse 6, he made haste and came down and received him joyfully. And when they saw it, they all complained, saying, he's gone to be a guest with a man who's a sinner. And then Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, look, Lord, I give half of my goods to the poor. We know this story, don't we? And if I've taken anything from anyone by false accusation, I restore fourfold. And Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, because he also is the son of Abraham. You know, I don't know how wealthy Zacchaeus was after he finished restoring fourfold. Because I believe that if was not a, well, if it turns out that I might have, I think that's an if in the sense of, yeah, I have. And so whatever I've taken goes back and gets restored four times. Was he wealthy after that? I don't know. And from the story we see it doesn't matter. What matters is that he was curious. He wanted to see Jesus, and Jesus said, you're curious, will you come down here? I'm going to stay at your house. Do you think they played pinochle that night? I don't think so. I think he heard about the gospel. I think he heard about the kingdom. And no, it's not recorded, so I can't tell you what was said. But do you honestly think that night that they sat around in front of the fire and talked about the weather? I don't think so. And Zacchaeus received this joyfully. He was so moved, he was so motivated by what he'd seen and heard and what he was experiencing right then that it was enough to make him want to change his life. And let me finish with Paul in prison. Paul, as hardworking a Christian and harder than he was ever a hardworking Pharisee, beaten, stoned, abused, who gave up everything, including his livelihood, and had to be supported entirely by other people, except from time to time when he worked as a tent maker. Paul was rewarded by humans for all of that by going to jail. And in Philippians 1, beginning in verse 12, he tells the church in Philippi who had supported him so faithfully, and so many things he'd done, he says, I want you to know, brethren, that the things which happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel. Well, Paul had lost his mind sitting there in the jail in Rome. It's good I'm here because the gospel has benefited. No, he hadn't lost his mind, and the gospel had benefited. Verse 13, he says, it's become evident to the whole palace guard and to all the rest, everyone else who was around him, but also the guard, Caesar's own special police, if you will, that my chains are in Christ. In other words, he hadn't done anything wrong. He was imprisoned because of his faith. And most of the brethren in the Lord, having become confident by my chains, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Now you go figure. Read that and think about what that says. Because they saw Paul in jail, the other Christians who were not there with him, whether that was in Rome or elsewhere, I'm not sure, but at the very least in Rome, had been emboldened because he was in jail to be bolder themselves and risk the same thing. Okay. Look at the influence. One man shackled up had on so many others. He couldn't go out. He couldn't book the Colosseum for an evening of gospel messages. Wow, wouldn't have that been great? No. He's set, shackled up, a prisoner. But look at the influence he had. No big PA system. No great speaker. Paul admitted to the Corinthians that it was kind of understood by a lot of people that he wasn't so great an orator. But look at the influence God allowed him to have. And so here's our application then, folks. If somebody asks, like Rahab and Ruth did, be willing to help. You may end up redeeming someone, being the instrument that God uses to bring them home, even if they were the ones who take the initiative. Don't prejudge people. There's a whole lot of people out there that you look at them and you think they're not going to be interested in the gospel. All right, you take 100 such people, you might very well find out that 75 of them don't have any interest, sure enough. But what about those who would have, if you had? What about them? What about Nathaniel? Invite everyone you know, even a skeptic. And if they're skeptics, just say, well, come on to church with me anyway. And meet the people here. They're just like you. They're normal. Come and meet my family. Tell them that. I want you to meet my family. They're going to be like, what? I thought you said come to church. I did. Well, you said meet your family. I did. Come to church and meet my family. Let them think about that. And Zacchaeus, the little guy, the rich little guy, the incredibly rich, very little guy, but he was still curious. He wanted to know. There's people around you that are curious. A lot of them may not climb up in a tree or do a whole lot to signal to you just how curious they are, but they're curious. You invite them and open your arms and see where that curiosity leads you in them. You see, none of this involves memorizing great expanses of Scripture. None of this involves being a great speaker. It just involves us loving and caring enough. And that's really all we need to do. Because evangelism involves us, but it's not about us. It's about Christ, and it's about salvation. And that's why Paul reminded the Corinthians that he may have planted the seed someplace. Apollos or anyone else might have come along and watered, but it's God who provides the results. He's not going to hold you accountable, folks, for what is his job and what he's reserved to himself. He's going to hold us accountable for what he's asked us to do. So let's plant and let's water and let's pray to God, just as Jesus himself prayed to the Father, to send forth reapers into the fields, because they are white. They always have been, and they are today. Please get out your songbooks. What about you? Here's an invitation for you. We always end with one. We're going to sing a song. It's an invitation song, because at this time, if you need Christ, you've never put him on. If you need to have your sins washed away, Christ's blood will flow for you today if you're baptized and become the day of gospel. Think about your spiritual condition. Let's stand and let's sing a song of invitation.